Good afternoon and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm your host, Maria Armudian. Today, we spend the hour exploring how the current rightward movement fits into U.S. history, how it developed, and how the movement has been changing U.S. politics and policies. What can we learn from the past rightward movements, both here and abroad, and how far can the movement go? Many commentators have attempted to connect and compare the current Tea Party movement to the historic populist movements. But populism may not be the correct analogy, say scholars, although populism, like Tea Partiers, had numerous strands, including authoritarianism, nationalism, and exploitation. It was primarily a movement for economic justice. Populism evolved over time. In the late 19th century, for example, the former Labor People's Party emerged. And then in the 1890s, populism fueled rural socialism in Oklahoma and Kansas, ultimately provoking reforms of the progressive era. Perhaps the more apt comparison would be to the conservatives in the 1930s who lambasted Franklin Roosevelt for the New Deal. They called him a fascist, a dictator, and a tyrant, despite the fact that he probably saved capitalism. Throughout the 20th century, rightist movements emerged as a result of social and political changes. In 1958, for example, business executives from the National Association of Manufacturers formed the John Birch Society to liberate America from what they called slavery of unions, minimum wage, social security, and, quote, socialist tyranny. The John Birch Society considered the civil rights movement an instrument of the, quote, communist conspiracy. They organized against, quote, one world government. And today, it seems these ideas are as alive as ever, fueling the rhetoric of rightist movements such as the Tea Party. These movements have effectively turned the clock back in numerous states, such as in Texas, which has rescinded laws that protect and encourage voters, like the motor voter laws. We're joined by three esteemed scholars. Kathleen Blee is Distinguished Professor and Chair of Sociology at the University of Pittsburgh. Her books include Democracy in the Making, How Activist Groups Form, Women of the Right, International and Transnational Perspectives, No Middle Ground, Women and Radical Protest. Lawrence Rosenthal is Executive Director and Lead Researcher of the Center for the Comparative Study of Right-Wing Movements. He is Professor of Sociology and Italian Studies at University of California, Berkeley, and the author of The Insurgent Right, that looks at the conservative movement in America. Martin Cohen is Professor of Political Science at James Madison University, and his studies examine the role of the right on electoral politics. Welcome, Kathleen Blee, and welcome, Lawrence Rosenthal.
Hi.
And welcome, Martin Cohen.
Hello.
I think I wanted to start with the whole concept of right wing versus left wing. And part of this arose in an argument I had with my own dissertation chair about these phrases and how limited they seem to be to actually capture the political dynamics of what they represent in people's minds. So I wonder if we can start with the actual phrases, right wing, left wing, and what we mean by them. Martin Cohen, would you like to start?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, we're talking about an ideology that someone has. When someone, mostly people who are sophisticated followers of the news and politics, generally have some underlying belief system that connects a lot of their different issue positions on a variety of different subjects. And, you know, we sort of know instinctively what is a right-wing and a left-wing position by some of the underlying things that come beneath it. For example, the role of government in terms of preserving morality. We know a stronger government presence there is a right-wing, currently a right-wing position, whereas government involvement in the economy is a left-wing issue. And it's become a bit easier to classify people right or left because right now in our history, these are very ideologies very much tied in with partisanship. And you have very few Republicans that are not considered conservatives or right-wing people, and you have very few Democrats who are not considered left-wing, and this has been the case, I would say, for about 30 years.
Would you agree with this, Lawrence Rosenthal?
Yes, I would. I would add that if you look at the right, there is something called classical conservatism, and classical conservatism is interested in essentially maintaining power in the hands of established figures and established forces. Beyond that, there's something which we could think of as more like an insurgent right, a right which is attempting to get into power. And that tends to be a more radical right. So the new right that has been in power for about 30 years in this country was an insurgent right relative to the conservatism that had come before it, the conservatism of the Republican Party in the 50s and 60s and 70s mostly. And to the extent to which the insurgent new right has come into power, the ideology that Marty Cohen refers to has become increasingly radical.
Kathleen Blee.
I agree in general, for sure, but I'm also intrigued by instances in which those right-wing and left-wing dichotomy breaks down. And so, for example, I've studied women in the far right, and you see a lot of far-right movements that, although they're clearly on the right, they have elements that don't fit as comfortably in what we might think of as a right-wing ideology. So, for example, the classic case is the 1920s Ku Klux Klan, by anyone's definition, a right-wing movement, but supporting women's suffrage and women's participation in politics and so forth, for its racist ends, of course. But, you know, there are, on the margins, ways in which people's political lives can be quite complicated and don't always fit neatly into that right-wing and left-wing division that we see more in political parties.
One of the places where it became a little bit convoluted was in a discussion about China, because China, having been called a communist country, which, you know, clearly it's not really a communist country anymore, but also acting in a very authoritarian way, it just seemed like the phrases in some place like China and other countries as well failed. Does that seem accurate to you, Martin Cohen?
Yeah, I think certainly in this country, what's right and left wing, I mean, I always remember looking at a long continuum of left versus right in the world, and America being, you know, left and right being the very middle of that and not very, very wide itself within the broader ideological spectrum. So I do think that in a comparative sense, it doesn't always work as it does in American politics. Even with the increasing globalization of the economy, I don't know that our politics has become more global than it has been before.
Well, let's take a look at the movements that you all have been studying here in the United States first, and then we'll take it more into a comparative context. If we were to look at both the roots of the current kind of right-wing movement, which might be perhaps identified mostly with the Tea Party, but there are others as well, if we could walk through the various strands throughout American history and then compare today's right with those of the past, what would we say? And Martin Cohen, I'm going to let you start on that.
Well, I think as far as the Tea Party is concerned, at least on the surface, it's been presented as sort of a populist conservatism, more based among middle class, let's say, more based outside of New England, where the sort of old right had been centered, and the centers of power in Wall Street and New England. I think the Tea Party is attempting, at least being branded as a continuation of what I would say was the new right beginning in the 1970s, which was much more aggressive politically, much less interested in intellectualism and much more interested in gaining power to actually change policies. So in my opinion, this newfound Tea Party, whether it is or not, if you look at the data, it doesn't necessarily suggest that it's dominated by people who are middle class or lower to middle class. But I think that it does seem to at least be branded as a continuation of the historical populist conservatism rather than sort of country club type republicanism.
Can you walk us through the populist movements, for example, as a possible way to bridge that, and who they really were?
Well, going back, I wouldn't say my expertise is going back much further than the interwar period, but certainly think about in the South, governors local politicians who were in favor of big government. They were in favor of government getting involved in civic areas and spending lots of money on schools and roads and infrastructure, but also having some sort of a basis and a ethnocentric type ideology, and often there was lots of virulent racism that was within these populist movements. And so the combination of government was there to help people economically, also government was also there to maintain a sort of status quo, whether it be a racial status quo or a moral status quo.
Lawrence Rosenthal?
I agree with Martin about the populist inheritance that one sees in the Tea Party. I would add to it that there is an inheritance of the particular conservative movement that has been continuous in this country, and a conservative ideology that has been continuous since the New Deal. There have been reactions from the right, beginning with the New Deal, people on the right who regarded Franklin Roosevelt as either a traitor to his class, a socialist. That word, much as it's being used today, was used to describe Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And that was a very much a minority view. It was isolated in relatively small numbers and had very little political sway until, beginning in the 1950s, and the key figure here is someone like William F. Buckley, it became a movement which grew and grew so that it seized the Republican Party presidential nomination in 64 with Barry Goldwater and eventually would win national power with Ronald Reagan. Now, one thing that somebody like Buckley is famous for having done was having rooted out the most extreme and radical voices in American conservatism, an example being the John Birch Society. One thing which is happening with the Tea Party, which is very interesting, is that it is resurrecting that extreme rightism that was read out of the conservative movement in the 1950s and 1960s by the most outstanding conservative movement entrepreneurs. And you see that ideology in figures like Glenn Beck, who has become something of an instructor to a large swath of the Tea Party, and his use of texts like Cleon Skousen, who was to the right of the founder of the John Birch Society himself. So that one of the really interesting things that I would add to what Marty Cohen had to say about populism is the resurrection of an extreme wing of American conservatism that hasn't had much purchase in Republican circles for 20, 30 years.
Let's bring Kathleen Blee in as well. Now, Kathleen Blee, you've looked at organized racism. You've looked at the Klan, particularly women in the Klan. Give us that perspective.
One thing I wanted to add to what was already said about the Tea Party first, though, is that Tea Party, as has already been mentioned, is not a movement driven by intellectuals. They're not really Tea Party intellectuals. It's much more diverse kind of movement. And so you have to kind of piece together the beliefs based on quite a conflicting set of ideas out there among different Tea Parties. But you see in a lot of Tea Party movements a real tension between people who are pulling on the kind of libertarian strand of conservatism, so against the big state, against government intervention, and people who are pulling on the religious right kind of strand of conservatism, which makes moral claims that require big government intervention. And so you see on the ground Tea Party movements in conflict over issues, sometimes even like abortion. So you have a libertarian strand, abortion is nobody's business, government shouldn't be involved, and a moral, religious moral stand coming out of the religious right saying the state has an interest in enacting morality by opposing abortion. So you see, I think, a different kind of tension that has been mentioned before in the Tea Party. Now, the Tea Party, for the most part, has maneuvered very carefully not to be associated with the far racist right, although certainly in some of the claims that are made both by its spokespeople and by Tea Party members, you know, very evocative of that, particularly in their xenophobia, but they're very careful not to be associated with the racist movements like the Klan and neo-Nazis. And in general, there's quite a large gulf between both the membership and even the ideas of the most conservative movements and these far-right movements. They're really kind of a different kind of conservative. They're much more extreme, much more conspiratorial than you would see in a movement like the Tea Party.
The factors that are giving rise to these movements gaining so much ground, of course, I think, I was going to say historically we didn't have funders like the Koch brothers, but I think we had the DuPont brothers back in the day that were also very right-leaning, shall we say. But it seems that, and I think some scholars argue, that this current strand is really a response to the political economy. Would you agree with that, Lawrence Rosenthal?
There's certainly a very strong dimension of that, owing to the financial crisis that hit libertarian views of against government involvement, regulation, and things of that nature. To some extent, have seized upon that moment to develop a populist following which wasn't available to them earlier. And Kathleen Blee is right to point out the problem that they run into in that so much of the constituency that they're attempting to mobilize have very different premises. Take, for example, the very notion of free market economics. The libertarians, at their extreme, base it on a hyper-rational defense of capitalism based in a figure like Ayn Rand, whereas the religious right bases it in their support for free market capitalism, a defense of it is emerging around a figure like David Barton, who we'll find in the New Testament, Jesus' position on the minimum wage and things of that nature. So that to the extent to which the Tea Party can keep itself going, they have to come up with some ways in which to resolve those kind of contradictions.
This is Kathleen Blee. I wanted to add that in addition to the political opportunity or opening that they have mobilized around in terms of the economy, the Tea Party also has its genesis in the political opening occasioned by Obama's election. And so it's in part, obviously, a reaction to a poor economy, but it's also in part a reaction to the election of an African-American president. And the Tea Party is often careful not to make very openly racist claims, but nonetheless, it's overwhelmingly a white movement. And there are a lot of very close to racial claims being made in the Tea Party about who's benefiting from the election of an African-American president and white, ordinary white people being disempowered. So that's a different kind of opening that they seized upon.
If we were going to talk about the distinctions between, say, this right-wing movement and maybe more moderates or even people that are more progressive, you know, psychologists are generally finding that there are very important differences even within the brain between people of strong leanings. Some of it seems to be physical. Some of it seems to be just that conservative, very conservative right-leaning people tend to be more afraid. And then there's, it seems to be a different intellect as well. Which one of you can speak to some of this?
I don't know that I can speak to it on a scholarly level, or at the level that your question is demanding. This is Larry Rosenthal. My sense of those arguments, one finds this in figures like Drew Weston and George Lakoff, that in fact the political brain has essentially a conservative side and a liberal side, and that there is the potential for either to become stronger, you know, to dominate one or the other, and that what political parties succeed in doing is putting together narratives that allow people to interpret particular things in the world. This is rather like what Marty described as ideologies. And those tend to dominate people's thinking, but not to the exclusion of the possibility of another side.
So you're saying that despite the potential physical elements of this, the neurological elements of this and psychological elements of this, it shouldn't cut off the other considerations?
Oh, no. I think to somatize it to the extent that politics becomes a matter of predestination is not only a strategic dead end, but has very little really to do with political behavior as we've seen it.
Martin Cohen, anything you'd like to add?
Just that I find my research a link between political conservatism and religious conservatism, in that you can look at the spectrum from liberal to conservative and really map out people who are on the left politically with those who tend to be a bit more modern and progressive in their religious beliefs and their doctrine. And so it becomes increasingly important to look at, not at the religious tradition or even denomination of individuals in terms of how religion might influence their politics, but more about what they think, you know, the religion is about and how orthodox the belief system is. And the analogy can probably break down, but you look at the way people believe about the Bible, whether the Bible should be taken literally. We look at the Constitution, whether the Constitution should be taken literally, and you find that the biblical literalists are most often those who at least think that they're gleaning the original intent of the founders. So I see a link between politics and religion, and what is linking that is beyond, you know, my expertise.
It sounds a little bit like it's also an intellectual issue. I don't know if this is actually true. I'm speculating out loud. The strong intellectual bent would continue to inquire into the issues rather than stick straight to the literal perspective of something like a constitution or a Bible, you would think. So it sounds like the intellectual approach is very different.
Fundamentalism began when part of Christianity decided to, you know, accept Darwinism, accept higher criticism of the Bible, you know, give a value to science and rationality. And those who, you know, didn't agree with that split off and they became fundamentalists. And so to this day, there is the issue of how much credence should science be given relative to faith, let's say. And I think, you know, that's going to determine people's views on many issues, from the environment to gay rights and even abortion, how much science should play a role.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm your host, Maria Armudian. We are exploring the development and the effect of the rightward movements in the United States and abroad. We'll continue after this short break. Stay tuned.
Into his chair, choking back the tears his fear realized. In the doorway, eyes swell with mother's tears as the uniforms draw near. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Scholar's Circle. I'm your host, Maria Armudian. We are continuing our conversation about how the current rightward movement fits into U.S. history, how it's been changing and changing U.S. politics and policies, and what we can learn from the past, both here and abroad. And we're speaking with three esteemed scholars. Kathleen Blee is Distinguished Professor and Chair of the Sociology Department at the University of Pittsburgh. Lawrence Rosenthal is Executive Director and Lead Researcher at the Center for Comparative Study of Right-Wing Movements at University of California, Berkeley. And Martin Cohen is Assistant Professor of Political Science at James Madison University. If we look at some of the other factors that may have given rise to what seems to be an empowerment of this very strong rightward movement, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like a lot of policies are being driven backwards since the New Deal into a more rightward direction. And when we look even at the leadership, we look at, say, President Nixon versus President Obama, and Nixon being a Republican who had Democrats in his cabinet, and his domestic policies were, by and large, left of what we might even say some of President Obama's policies are. So there seems to have been a creep moving farther and farther to the right on such issues. What has empowered that? And how much is, say, mass media and changes in mass media?
This is Larry Rosenthal. You bring up a question which is widely debated, which is, yes, Nixon, by the standard of today, we could argue Nixon was notably to the left of Bill Clinton in terms of domestic policy. And how did that come to be? Plainly, the central event is the takeover of the Republican Party by what was then called movement conservatives in the 70s, which was finalized with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, and since then the movement to the right has been rather like a march, and the whole of the political spectrum has moved right. The arguments about that are, what was it that allowed this movement conservatism to develop to the level where it could sustain an electoral majority in the country? And there are a lot of arguments about that. One is the rise of the so-called social movements in the 1970s, reactions against the revolutions of the 60s, the cultural revolutions of the 60s. There are arguments which are about reactions against the loss in Vietnam and the anti-war movement as having been responsible for that, and then by implication the Democratic Party having been responsible for that. So a version of nationalism and resentment which we hadn't seen before, which arose in that period. And then a third level of that argument is generally, it goes under the heading of the rise of neoliberalism, which is about a structural change in the economy that has brought about a kind of triumphant free market ideology, which not only has moved American politics and economy to the right, but has had that effect globally.
I could just add that, it takes two sides to move the center. And while the Republicans have embraced movement conservatism and moved further towards the right, the Democrats have run away from what maybe you could call movement liberalism since the 1960s. And with both sides moving to the right, then necessarily the center moves to the right. And I think that has a lot to do with why the policy space has moved to the right, even after Democratic victories, either presidential or congressional.
Kathleen Blee, we have not heard from you in a few minutes. Let's bring you back in. You also study social movements and how they form, how they fall apart. I wonder if part of this is also that the louder movements have been more conservative and then magnified, like I said at the beginning of this question, perhaps magnified by a media that has moved a little bit more, maybe a lot more, to the right.
That's another factor that's shifted the country to the right has been the incredible organization of the New Right, which really pioneered new ways to organized social movements effectively. So starting in the 70s and continuing today, the new right, Christian right, forms of the right have shown amazing abilities to form networks, to tie financial resources to grassroots mobilization, to market their messages, to tie their messages to media outlets, you know, the rise of Fox News, but also other kinds of grassroots and local media. Radio media was very important in the rise of the religious right. So people think of the 1960s progressive movements as being kind of the quintessential social movement form. But in many ways, the right of the 70s, 80s, 90s has been even more effective in creating a kind of social movement that would push the electorate to the right, that would push institutional politics very far to the right.
Can you give any specific examples of some of these more innovative means that the right side movements have used?
Well, for example, mass marketing. The right in the 70s and 80s was very effective in putting together lists of people who could be mobilized at the grassroots and directing tailored messages to them through mailing. Now that's all been taken over by emailing and all kinds of others. But, you know, the concept of getting your message down to the voter, to the activist, bringing people into politics from their homes. Women were very involved in that in a lot of ways, organizing women basically in kitchens throughout, especially the West Coast, bringing people together to talk about problems, formulate a conservative agenda at a local level, run for school board, run for city council. You know, it was a really different way of organizing civic activism that pushed electoral politics to the right.
It strikes me as there are two other factors here as well, and one does have to do with the financial support. You know, a lot of people are talking, of course, now about the Koch brothers and their funding of the Tea Party movement, but it seems that that has been going on in various forms for a while. There have been some studies showing how the corporate CEOs organized in response to some of those 60s and 70s movements, trying to move the country more economically to the right. And then we had, of course, the Christian right movement bonding with some of these more corporate, more moneyed interests. And now it seems we have a gigantic number and power level of particular kinds of interest groups. How much is that influencing the direction and the ability of these new right to move and grow? Marty Cohen?
You're right in that big money has found a way to mobilize the grassroots, and whether, you know, the big argument when the Tea Party burst onto the scene was whether it was top-down or whether it was bottom-up, and somehow one was more legitimate than the other. And it really didn't matter which is which, which way the arrow goes, the fact that they were both aligned together. And, you know, in the 70s, the early New Right period, you certainly have the sort of grassroots efforts, as Kathleen said, to make, you know, to build these lists of Republican and conservative supporters. But you also had tons of oil money. You had tons of beer money from Joseph Kors. And there's always been no shortage of corporate money for right-wing movements. And in particular, very helpful that in many ways sometimes they can hide that money through a sort of populist message. And I certainly think the corporate money that has been on the right you know, certainly predates corporate money being more evenly divided among the parties.
I wanted to add something to what Marty was saying.
Yes, please.
The two things. One is there's a very clear, well-known history of the right self-consciously deciding in response to the 1960s that it was necessary to develop a counter ideology to what was emerging then as the counterculture, one which again was pro-business and right-wing money poured in for that and created the various think tanks that have been responsible for churning out the policies that have run the Reagan administration and more recently ran the Bush administration. And the self-consciousness around that was very clear. The other thing, which is sometimes you don't see the giant elephant in the room or you just ignore it, about the right and money and the media. Fox News is an extraordinary thing. Fox News is developed, is first funded by right-wing media magnate, Rupert Murdoch, and to develop Fox News, he brought in Roger Ailes, who was generally regarded in the late 80s as the Republican kingmaker. That is to say, he was the Republican political consultant who auditioned candidates for them to hire him rather than the other way around. And he developed Fox News. So the relationship between a television network and a political party that developed with Fox News is something that really never existed before. It kind of makes you think of things like, you know, the Democratic Party developing since the 20s and 30s with in conjunction with the union movement, so that there's a structure out there in what social scientists like to call civil society that is in lockstep with a political party. Now we have a television network, and that's a fairly unusual and extraordinary thing. The most significant analog to that is Italian politics, where the individual who literally owned all of private television, what we would call the networks other than PBS in Italy, formed a political party. This is Silvio Berlusconi, and has been for most of the last 15 years the political head of state. So that the merging of a political party and a television network seems to be at in line with the evolution of networking means and other innovations which the right has been in the forefront of, with people like Richard Viguerie from the 1970s, but has now kind of blossomed into this utterly new form.
And, of course, there's the radio, too, the AM talk radio shows that have been flourishing for quite some time, and the consolidation of mass media that kind of streamlined the message. It's like this, I think the communication scholars like Kathleen Hall Jamieson calls it an echo chamber now, where you hear a single frame repeated in multiple media and to the point where it starts to sound very real. Kathleen Blee, would you like to comment? Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead. Marty Cohen, is that you?
No, this is Larry Rosenthal. There is this mechanism which is pretty well known by now. I mean, anybody who watches Jon Stewart would know this, that these think tanks and the message of the day and the message of the week, people on the right, raise an issue, an unhappiness. And then it gets reported on the networks starting or in the right-wing newspapers as news and politics. And so you generate a discussion around terms of debate that have been entirely defined and self-consciously defined by the right. This is pretty well known now.
Kathleen Blee, would you like to come in?
In the conservative movement, like Tea Parties, that's very much echoes what goes on in the far right, is this repeating of outlandish claims. There'll be some claim like that Obama's not born in the United States. So it's the simple message, very clear. It's a little tiny sound bite. It's one claim. It's extremely outlandish, so it has shock value. People hear it. And the refutation of it only seems to make it stronger. So refuting it just shows that there are enemies out there who want to distort the claim, which makes the claim stronger. It's a technique that racist movements use all the time, and you really now see it in groups like the Tea Party. So it's very hard to break those kinds of claims, because the more evidence that seems to weigh against the claim, the more that just shows that there are enemies out there that are trying to destroy the truth, and it makes the so-called truth seem stronger. And media outlets like Fox News, but also the call-in radio and the daytime radio shows, are very instrumental in populating, repeating those claims and giving them a political force.
Anything you'd like to add, Marty Cohen?
No, I agree with what both Larry and Kathleen have said.
There was an article in Salon.com that really argued that much of the rightward movements are a money-making machine for a lot of the leaders, and that it's not necessarily ideologically driven by the leaders as much as it's really money. How would one of you respond to that? Marty Cohen?
I would believe it. I think that makes sense to me. I mean, there's entrepreneurs, political entrepreneurs out there. And certainly people do go into politics, a career, and in any career, people are looking for the opportunity to make a living. You know, certainly I would say that on both sides, that's a possibility.
Kathleen Blee?
There's been a tendency on some parts of the right in at least recent American history. So the 1920s Klan, many people would argue, was not so much a political movement as a money-making operation. It was started by these couple entrepreneurs from Texas who had basically a pyramid scheme to collect people's dues. And along the way, people got involved in the agenda and the politics. But at base, it really was a money-making scheme. So the part of the religious right that came out of the televangelist movement, televangelism, you know, part of it was very much money-making by some entrepreneurial folks at the top, so that this would not be unprecedented as a mode of politics.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, and I'm your host, Maria Armudian. We are exploring the development and the effect of the rightward movements in the United States and abroad. We'll continue after this short break. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to a special hour-long Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. We're exploring the history and impact of right-wing movements, particularly why and how they develop and how far they usually advance, both here and abroad. With us are three scholars who specialize in this area. Kathleen Blee is Distinguished Professor and Chair of Sociology at the University of Pittsburgh. Her books include Democracy in the Making, How Activist Groups Form, Women of the Right, International and Transnational Perspectives, No Middle Ground, Women and Radical Protest. Lawrence Rosenthal is Executive Director and Lead Researcher of the Center for the Comparative Study of Right-Wing Movements. He is Professor of Sociology and Italian Studies at University of California, Berkeley, and the author of The Insurgent Right, that looks at the conservative movement in America. Martin Cohen is Professor of Political Science at James Madison University, and his studies examine the role of the right on electoral politics. One of the other phenomena that I don't know if people have studied as closely yet is that some of the new Tea Party movement types are running people for local elections, say school board elections, in these various towns and cities across the United States, taking over school boards and then defunding programs or classrooms or this sort of a thing. So starting from a very grassroots level there, how much of that have you seen? Kathleen Blee, have you seen that in your studies?
I haven't seen it in the Tea Party group, although that's not an uncommon strategy among the right World War II to run people in very local offices. You see that in the 1970s and 80s, right? You see that also in the far right. That's a common mode of politics. It's sort of politics under the radar, getting to politics sort of where people live, where they can start making an impact on their local situation with very fairly small numbers of people.
Marty, yeah. I would argue that the Christian right itself didn't become the powerful force that it is today, both within the Republican Party and American politics in general, until the focus was on the local level, whether that be, you know, school board races, city council races, county commissioner races, and even maybe more importantly, running for local Republican positions, precinct captains. There were many instances where local Republican parties were just completely taken over by religious conservatives. And then from that level, it built up to the county level and to the state level, where you had state Republican parties that were clearly dominated by Christian conservatives. And in my opinion, that's how the Republican Party was brought to the right by religious conservatives, not by, you know, Pat Robertson running for president, not by trying to amend the Constitution to ban abortion, but by, you know, going into the local precincts and throwing out the pro-choice Republicans, throwing out, you know, maybe the social moderates, Republicans, and really, you know, making it more ideologically pure. And, you know, some people on the left, you know, say, well, what can we do, you know, to have an impact? You know, I would say that the same thing. Start at the lower levels of the Democratic Party and move them to the left by basically taking over the positions of power within the party.
Yeah, Marty Cohen, let's talk about that for just a quick second. And I hear you coming in, Lawrence Rosenthal, and there, I have I'm going to bring you in a second, but Marty Cohen, you wrote about parties and about how really it requires for people to move a policy direction. It requires people to move through one of the two major parties, that new parties are very hard to establish, that old parties are very hard to die, and that mostly it's by moving the existing two parties in the United States that they get a policy agenda forward. And it's been largely by nominating particular kinds of candidates. Talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, I mean, the nomination process is really the most important thing that a party does. And, you know, whoever the nominee is, whether it's at the national level as a president, or at the state level, the governor, or local level, the state representative, the nominee is the face of the party. And, you know, you can't win unless you get nominated. And so the big focus for the Christian right became on these Republican nominating campaigns. And at first, they ran into some major problems. They ran into a lot of pushback from the old guard Republicans. And there were lots of bitter primary fights, and sometimes the Christian candidate would win, and then the moderates would desert him or her. The Republicans would lose a seat. Sometimes the Christian candidate would lose, and Christian conservatives would then stay home, and the Republican would lose a seat. So it was very antagonistic in the beginning. But once the sort of, you know, once they decided to keep their eye on the ball and identify a common enemy and say, well, okay, we might not win this nomination campaign, but it's more important that Republicans get into office. And now this isn't as much of a problem because, you know, there are really no more moderate Republicans to many extent. It's conservative versus extremely conservative in these nominating campaigns. But yes, I believe that the parties are where the change comes from, and in order to control parties, you need to control nominations.
Lawrence Rosenthal, I heard you coming in.
I wanted to say that there is evidence, and I have read a paper recently that has documented that post the 2010 election, that a number of Tea Party groups have very self-consciously decided that they were, for at least this year, were going to concentrate on local elections. and that you know, things like school boards and get the Tea Party candidates to displace others in local leadership positions. And I would simply echo with respect to that what Marty said about this was very much the way in which the religious right got their foothold in the Republican Party.
Kathy Blee, I'd like to bring you in to talk a bit about the gender issues. A lot of people have thought of these rightward movements as a lot of white men. You argue that there are a lot of women in these movements as well. Talk to us about the women in these right-wing movements.
In the 20th century, women have been quite active in a number of right movements, although almost never at the leadership level and very rarely at the level of spokespeople. So sometimes women are quite visible in these movements relative to their numbers, their activism. But, you know, from the Klan in the 20s to the Tea Party today, but maybe particularly in the new Christian right, the religious right, women were very active at the grassroots level in these kitchen caucuses, in the school board races, in the organizing people in churches, and organizing churches in common campaigns. A lot of that work is kind of personal, face-to-face networking politics, and women were very influential, but for a variety of reasons, including the generally negative sense of women as spokespeople for political causes that's common in the right, rightist movements don't often put women up front or in front of cameras, although obviously now we see some exceptions. But as base members, women have been very involved.
And if you were going to say who these women are and what draws them to these rightward movements, what would you say?
Well, you could say cause and effect are a little confusing here, but women are very involved in movements that often have social and family issues at their base. But it could be that women are in these movements and that move those movements in that direction too. But, you know, the religious right, women were very involved in movements around, obviously, abortion, all kinds of morality, anti-gay movements and so forth. But those are typically the kinds of movements that women get involved in, movements that have some argument about schooling, movements against public schooling or for homeschooling. Those kinds of conservative issues have been very effective in mobilizing women, and women have moved those movements toward those issues.
What effect...
May I?
Yes,
may
please.
I add to that a bit? It appears... and there are some studies that are coming out that suggest this. It appears that, in fact, that may be undergoing some change. There may be some change with respect to what Kathleen describes with in the context of the Tea Party.
Right.
That is to say that, in fact, women are spokespeople for it. And what seems to be emerging among... in some studies, is that women on the right have seen the Tea Party uniquely as an opportunity for them to assume leadership positions in a way that has not been possible in previous right-wing and right-wing movement organizations. And, in fact, there is conversation about things called... People use the phrase right-wing feminism to describe this development, and we can all see the figures like Sarah Palin, Michelle Bachmann, being very much spokespeople for the Tea Party right, and the development of phrases like Mama Grizzlies, which suggest that mothering in and of itself commends one for political leadership.
Lawrence Rosenthal, one last question, and this goes to you because this is more in your area. Can you compare what has happened in the United States with these movements with what you are seeing happening in other parts of the world, particularly Europe?
Well, as I suggested earlier, the closest thing to what we see in the Republican Party and the Tea Party that I know of in Europe is what has happened in Italy over since about 1994. And what happened there was that the existing conservative establishment actually fell apart there, and there was a vacuum. And what filled the vacuum was something much further to the right than had been viable as a national political force in Italy earlier. And Berlusconi, who introduced this almost post-industrial version of a political party made up in his first campaigns, it was notable that he would be interviewed on television. He would essentially be interviewed by his own employees. It was a rather extraordinary thing.
Could you see this happening in Greece now?
Greece. Greece is a hard one because Greece has their autonomy to do things right now is so limited owing to the EU, the European Union, so that the nature of something independent, just Greek homegrown, that might be a political development is really constricted there. I don't think you'd get the possibility that you had, across the sea in Italy.
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank all three of you. Kathleen Blee, professor of and chair of the Sociology Department, University of Pittsburgh. Thank you so much. Yeah. Professor Lawrence Rosenthal, executive director and lead researcher of the Center for Comparative Study of Right-Wing Movements at UC Berkeley. Thank you.
Thank you.
Martin Cohen, assistant professor of political science at James Madison University. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and special thanks to Ankina Aghasyan, who produces the show with me. Also, special thanks to Ishmael Karim, our assistant producer. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can always go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives. You can keep up with us on thescholarscircle.org or armoodian.com. See you next week.